Hey everybody, it's Kevin and it's Donna, and it is the second episode of The Med List. Super excited to have you guys here with us. If you guys are here live, fantastic. If you're listening on an episode on any of our socials or Spotify or Apple Podcasts, then hey, subscribe, like, listen, and share. Let's get this thing started. Donna, what do you say?
Sounds perfect.
All right, Donna. So we have a really fun guest today that I don't think a lot of people would have thought you and I would be talking to, which when we usually think of deprescribing, if I wrote out a list of who are going to be the top deprescribing interviews, pharma would not have been on that list. But you introduced me to Ray, and what a great guy. And I think he's really going to open up some minds on what we think.
Yeah. So welcome. And thank you, Ray, for being with us today. So Ray Verano, we met this year, and we've have some common denominator people in our lives. And but I have to say, we're learning a lot from each other, I think, in regards to pharma, thinking about our older adults and thinking about where meds are headed, especially for older adults, thinking about safety for them. And really, I like to think of it too as, you know, the beers list and what's pharma doing in order to reduce those risks. And I think that there's some really great products that are coming out that are more targeted and safer for older adults that we'll probably get into. But just kind of wanted to talk to you a little bit in kind of introduce you, Ray, in regards to, you know, we got to look at our whole healthcare system. And part of that whole healthcare system is not only the insurance companies, but also the manufacturers and pharma themselves, the pharmacists, the patients, the providers, those writing for it. So, you know, Kevin, I know you said we really weren't going to be thinking about this, right? As to pharma, you know, come on the show. But I think it's so important that we get everybody involved, that our message for better, healthier outcomes and optimizing medicines is spread throughout the entire gamut of the healthcare system, including pharma. So Ray, welcome. Thank you for being with us. And I'm going to let you talk a little bit more about you and in your thoughts on this whole idea of optimizing medications and where pharma fits for that for both providers and patients.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come on here. It's a pleasure to get to know you both over the past year. Again, like Donna said, my name is Ray Verano. I am a PharmD and have my MBA as well. I'm a medical science liaison in industry. I also still work per diem at a large academic center in Boston as a pharmacist. Less and less, but still a little bit of just a teeny bit of clinical work. But mainly working with geriatrics in my industry setting. So my role, just like as a very brief high overview, it's in medical affairs. And, you know, without getting too deep into it, you know, I don't work within a function of commercial or, you know, commercials or marketing, sales, dollar amount, really. I work on the medical side with physicians on how, well, first of all, to educate them, but in that process, how do we gain insights to improve clinical outcomes, right? And I think it's extremely relevant to deprescribing as far as these outcomes. But it's a medical science liaison, it's a role. And I think, although I don't work necessarily in that commercial aspect, right? Getting a product to the end, I think I thought a lot about this weekend. And when we think of products and all these meds, right? And how our predominantly just older patients, but lots of patients with different disease states can be on all of these medications, right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about purchasing something, right, like on the shelf as a consumer, there's something about it like that you like, right? And it almost seems, at least as far as from a patient perspective, you're almost just like forced to take something. Doctor says this, doctor says that. But if you think about from a patient's view, and we'll work backwards as to why, you know, we really would love to see more deprescribing just as a result to show or identify outcomes, is the experience, right? So in this case, you may be on other medications or not. We'll just start very basic and then sort of build up to what our patients look like. But, you know, so like one, an easy thing would be price, right? Is this hindering my life to purchase this new medication despite the outcomes? I think plenty of the audience can probably think of many scenarios where that happens, but things like onboarding a new medication, right? And even if you're only on two, if the other medication is causing a skin resistant effect and an adverse event, now that it's been onboarded, you may feel as though like, oh, this new medication I'm taking, it's really upsetting my stomach to the point where I don't really enjoy it, right? It's not, the benefit isn't worth the risk on a personal level. Other patients can take the exact same two drugs, feel exactly fine. And even that patient that may be feeling different about an adverse effect could take the two drugs separately with no issue, right? And then things like, you know, I'm trying to speak very broadly, but another anecdote would be, you know, so you're on drug X and then you take drug Y, and due to their interactions, one may be subtherapeutic, but, you know, we don't see that stuff in clinical trials, and we most certainly don't see it in our phase 3 randomized controlled trials that are what get our drugs to market here in the United States. So I think that's sort of like a good groundwork is what I thought from a high level, but you know, I'd love you guys a little bit of feedback, and we can even review the drug process if you want to show the audience.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think, you know, Ray, if you can for us, because like being at MSL, I feel like that was something upon my graduation from pharmacy school was almost something that was really not heard of, and it became more popularized and now has become a very integral scientific position. But typically I'm thinking our audience that are patients and thinking we have an individual that has a pharmacy background that is working with a pharmaceutical company, they think drug rep, and you already stated at the very beginning, you're not related to sales, et cetera. So tell us this, I guess, Ray, when it comes to the evolution of the industry and your role in particular of what you do, why is that important to patients? Like, why should they know that this is the way pharmaceutical companies are working with their doctors today?
Yeah, that's great. Great question. And thanks. It's really all in line with not just how I feel personally and a passion, but it is really where the industry is going. So I think to, you know, address the stigma, it's you go through this process, you may get approved, you may not, depending on a clinical trial. Very latent term gets approved, and then assuming it's the first in class or it was in a head-to-head trial, you're on it, right? I have this disease. I am now a candidate for drug X. But the markets are becoming pretty competitive, right? We have a lot of medications out there, a lot that are approved. And it's not just, well, it's approved, so now you should take it. I think a lot of pharma used to be that way. We're now payers and, you know, without getting too deep, more specifically, PBMs are making these formularies, right? And if these certain medications don't necessarily have a head-to-head trial, there's ways to identify between them. There's ways that aren't so great, like sort of pitting them against each other for price, but there are good things that come out of this, right? So the industry is always evolving. And the way that I think, you know, I can say we, but across all therapeutic areas and across all companies are looking at different types of outcomes, right? So going back to what I said about a clinical trial, if you're in a clinical trial, you take a placebo or not, you have a scale, maybe, you know, a lot in neuro, there's scales, there could be lab values, how much did it lower your blood pressure, right? But when it gets to the end, and Donna takes the medication, or and I take the medication, you take the medication, we're not in theory all going to have our blood pressure lowered the exact amount, right? And then we're also not all going to have these same adverse effects. So Donna's maybe a perfect candidate, right? Lowers blood pressure, no problem, every day. May lower my blood pressure, but I am queasy, right? I have to take it with meals, or like my day is ruined. I can't focus. Whatever, in and out of the bathroom, you name it. This, whatever a patient may have, and these adverse events may not be reported in the trial, right? And Kevin can have it the worst, no effect, and also adverse events. So these outcomes are like newer, sort of not always a study, but ways to identify these patients right now. Just because that scenario I said, it doesn't mean, you know, Caucasian women are going to respond the best, because this is just anecdotally, right? But that example of what I just said is what pharma and the industry really want to find out, right? And we want to know these outcomes. Which one of us had more hospital visits this year, right? Which ones of us had an exacerbation within the disease state, whatever it may be. So those things aren't just good for the experience, like I said, for us as patients. You know, if Donna's taking the medication, she feels great, but she's still going to the hospital, it's hard to understand those things, because I may be suffering, right? Like day to day, I don't feel so good, but I don't go to the hospital. So this experience is like so hard to pin down. It's like, who's going to the hospital? The clinical trial may have only went 12 weeks and now we're taking it for years. Who's affected? Who responds the best? Now, all of that is so confusing, right? Now imagine I'm on 10 other medications, right? and Don's on a different 9 medications. How can we as an industry or as trailblazers, researchers, developers ever identify outcomes with so many other factors? And that's a lot of the problem with, you know, our drug approval process to begin with, sort of taking what little information we know, making a massive decision, right? We have a molecule and it's like, well, what disease should we treat? It's going to cost $1 billion. Let's get it right. Right. But we only have this much information. I think that restarts once the drug gets to the market. And how do we identify that, right? There's no more to just go on formulary and you're going to take it. I think payers and clinicians and advocacy groups, as well as the industry, have sort of all aligned that we want more, right? It's that same consumer experience. Sounds very businessy, but how come you're paying so much for something like in your personal life to enjoy, like a service or a widget or anything? Yet we feel as though we pay so much for healthcare and it's like, take this. Well, what if I'm not feeling better? Well, this is what you're supposed to take. This is what the guidelines say. Or this is what your insurance is paying for. This is what's on formulary, right? Mm-hmm. So all of those things, I think I like laying out at first while we talk about this, because all of that can just muddy the waters as to how do we succeed in the industry. Mm-hmm. Now, on top of all that, we have multiple medications that can affect things.
Yeah.
But that I think is, you know, without getting too specific, I try to use very general anecdotes. I think the baseline of why the industry is definitely changing.
Well, and I love, Donna, that he said muddy the waters, and then I'll let you go ahead and answer your question. You asked your question because I'm sure we're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, no. So what I'm curious about is, so you mentioned early on that you are educating providers, but I'm sure that the providers and prescribers are also potentially educating you from the scenario that you just had stated in regards to, you know, once it's out in the market and there's more people taking it, and then we get more data and more outcomes and able to figure out a little bit further with how the medication is doing. So I think that that's really important too, to understand, you know, what is that education, that ebb and flow, and how does that affect patient outcomes and maybe guidelines or various things like that you're specifying?
Yep. And that's why I really do love my job. It's exactly what you just said, right? So a little bit of what I said mixed with a little bit of what you said is, we have a clinical trial. We know the drug works, right? Theoretically, maybe not in every specific individual, but we want it out to our public. The FDA has decided that this is going to be beneficial. But that's just the start. So when clinicians who may see, depending on the disease state, obviously, you know, rare disease is not this case, but they may see 400 or 500 patients taking this medication. And as I educate them, they're educating me with, you know, I see a lot of this. I know this is what happened in your clinical trial, but your clinical trial was 24 weeks. You know, I've had patients on this for 2 years. I find it really works well when I restart post-op. I think it works really well in this demographic, right? So now we have that long timeline of to get the drug approved. Mm-hmm. And then it has to get out there. And then patients have to be on it for 2-3 years. And then we have to hear from our providers. And then we have to design a new trial, maybe, you know, not a as extensive as something to get approved, but, you know, how do we truly tell if drug X works best in an African-American population, right? Or if drug X, you know, has better responders in more severe disease, right? So that's something theoretical. It's like if a medication treats a disease, the more severe the disease, maybe they do better. That's what you would think, but none of this we know, right? Mm-hmm. And by the time it gets to the end, you know, they're going back to like the greedy pharma, right? When we think about what our patients may think.
Yeah.
So that's perfect, right? We'll take a look at this. So this is all before, and this is, we have basic research, we make a decision, let's go for high blood pressure, right? We have discovery, preclinical, as we're going through those purple boxes. We try it in humans, then we try it in healthy humans, 100 people, just to make sure there's no safety issues. Then in our like phase two trial, when you see the green arrows there, we're usually treating patients with the disease, right? Almost always. In rare cases where it would be unethical to receive placebo, like in oncology, not everyone is getting drug or placebo, right? Just like a sugar pill. So it's not always the case, but for the terms of our conversation, we'll just make it easier today, right? So come phase two, they are taking a different drug. But phase two really shows us, you know, some endpoints. Maybe we'll get to see what patients respond better. How do we run the clinical trial? Things like that. And phase three is really what the FDA looks like to prove superiority. Sometimes it might be against the standard of treatment. Like I said, in cases where the standard of treatment would be, you know, the ethical decision instead of giving patients nothing. But then we get to FDA review, and then we get to post-market. And when we get to that post-market, that's sort of when I feel this passion that we restart. So just to go off of what I just paused saying is, you know, pharma may seem greedy. When we get to that endpoint, it's time to now, you know, recoup research costs, whatever it may be. But let's say there's like 8 to 10 years on patent. So now the patients are taken for 2 years. I talk to my physicians, advanced practice providers, pharmacists, the whole care team, depending on the disease state. And they say, well, you know, I think this is really where it works. These patients that may have, I don't know, comorbid dementia, overlapping pathologies, things like that, right? To start and design a new trial for a pharmaceutical company, just for the drug to go generic, maybe at the end of 8 years, is sort of where it boils down to like a greedy pharma. But it doesn't mean that we don't want that, right? We just can't identify it in what I just showed on the screen,
right?
Because of the way the FDA process has been, which is, this is not a, the FDA should change their process. But often those don't get funded by pharma, right? And then they become generic. And then they fall into a space where a lot of researchers want to independently look, but they can only look at their site. Even if they're at a top tier academic in a city, diverse population, it's still limited, right? Mm-hmm. And then we never truly know like what subgroups, what patient populations, which stage of disease is extremely effective, because it's now just being put on with everyone, right? And this is like part of why we get put on so many medications, because it may be first in class and they may have 5 or 6 of those, right? And then they've been on it for 20 years. It's like, do we know these drugs work past 20 years sometimes? Yeah. So I know I'm throwing out like a million examples as I talk, yeah. But I hope working through this,
yeah,
to see like how complex this can get. Yeah. But that's our job to figure right. this out.
Or faster. And you're singing our song too about, you know, how long are you supposed to be on these for? Yeah. You know, what is for life when we're living longer too? So that harm versus benefit.
I think the muddy the water statement that you made earlier, Ray, I love it because remember when we were kids, we first learned that if you put this color together, red and blue together, it makes purple, right? Really easy. You just have two factors you put together and you can see the end result. What Ray gets to work with is brown.
Yeah, amazing. Colors
into the mix, right? And you just have brown. You have no idea why it's brown or what colors are there. It's just enough of them that have been mixed to make brown. And so I think for all the patients listening, all the clinicians listening, there's a ton of data that as an MSL, you guys have at your disposal related to preclinical trials, right? But then after that happens, to really get rid of the brown and get an idea of, you know, what elements are really going to be factors for you as a patient to take a drug effectively, safely, monitor it correctly, and move off other drugs to this, you know, particular treatment. Having other drugs on top of those regimens that shouldn't be there in the first place makes that a very difficult picture to clear up. Ray, so give us this, when we're talking deprescribing and your seat that you're sitting in now, how does pharma try to help our clinicians to deprescribe? Like what is the role? Give us a couple scenarios of what you do to pull some meds off a regimen.
Yeah, that's a great question. So trying to tie it all to the same theme is we want answers, right? So why does pharma want to deprescribe? We want answers. And through that, we need really to like isolate, I'm just going to use the pronoun, like our product, right? Not specifically my company, but we want to isolate our product because something we can control is the other medications that patients are taking. Now, in a clinical trial, there is inclusion and exclusion criteria. And the inclusion criteria may be has not taken X class of medication 1 year prior. And then they will say, you know, will not, you know, exclusion would be additional therapy on top. So you have like, oh boy, it's so complex. I wish I had an easel on the thing. I'm sure they do that for podcasts, but it's not that complex, right? So you have drug, you know, drug X and drug Y, and it may look like this in a clinical trial just because it's head to head. But if it's in the space, if drug X works so much better with what these patients are taking, whether it be what older treatment was for this individual disease, would be one case. If they this patient population has a huge prevalence in another disease, right? So like, you know, in ASCVD risk and diabetes, very common. If it works better with these diabetes drugs may enhance its efficacy, may enhance its adverse event profile. It may keep people out of the hospital, right? So these things aren't just, oh, all right, here you go. This is the answer. It's going on formulary. But I think we don't have enough time to identify how we really get that. So when these, I'm back to talking about to physicians, right? Not just physicians, but talking to anyone on the healthcare team, we can get these insights to sort of hear how best to shape our product. And then, you know, it sounds cheesy, but it's like, we want what's best for the patient because it's better for everyone, right? I'm just speaking pragmatically. The better patients respond, the better the consumer experience, the better you feel, the more value you feel, like the longer you live. Caregivers, talking a lot about, you know, this population on this podcast, really, like the caregivers is a huge part. So that's a good example. Sorry, I didn't really organize my thoughts, but that was a good one that I didn't really think about, right? So there have been companies that have done studies on caregiver burden, right? So not just drug X is better than Y, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, drug X may be a little bit better than drug Y, but we noticed that their rates of depression, right? Like something else that these patients suffer from concomitantly frequently with a high prevalence, they may also benefit, right? So these are like all encompassing things that we will hear from physicians.
Yep.
As like my team and my role. But then it's like, well, how do we translate that back to the patient. Because in the clinical trials, we do some of this, for full disclosure, right? We do look at different subgroups. We do look at patients that were taking other medications, maybe not necessarily a competitor, but generics that are like being frequently taken with that disease state.
Of course.
That's the data that Kevin was talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That the FDA won't be putting on a package insert. Okay, so if you have, you know, you both have patients that have, or we'll use the heart disease and diabetes, right? You'd be like, wow, they're doing so much better on SGLT2 inhibitors.
I was going to ask about that.
Perfect. That's an easy one. But we may have a subgroup analysis in the clinical trial that showed, you know, here's our results, right? Whatever it may look like, this or this. And it's like, well, we looked at the patients that were taking SGLT2s. But if it's not powered, you know, or a primary endpoint, the FDA is not going to put that on an FDA label. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that isn't stuff that I freely talk about. But as we get into these this two-way street of education and insights with physicians is sort of how we identify through secondary endpoints in the clinical trial.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, anecdotes, right? I mean, if you see 500 patients and 8 to 10 physicians who see that many patients agree, you know, then we're onto something, right?
What about the opposite, Ray? What happens if we're onto something, but you and I have heard, and Donna, you've heard the same, we're onto something and we see that a medication is working really well for a particular population, but guess what? They can't get it.
Yep. So
time stops them from getting that medication that their doctor feels like is going to work best for them. They may have even started it at one time, but they just made an insurance change and now they can't get it any longer. What's the reason why this struggle happens so often for every piece of the industry, including patients?
Yeah. So this is another part of like the pharma persona that is still very common. So goes on. I think it's getting better. Right. And it's not, hey, we're paying, you know, pharma's paying for more. Or I truly believe that as we move forward with our therapy. So let's just take something that's becoming generic now. So like monoclonal antibodies, mm-hmm. usually IVs for our audience, usually IVs, you have to go in maybe once a week. But the outcomes are much better and they're more well tolerated than maybe taking a pill that you kind of forget you have to take with, you know, a food or not food, or you're taking with another pill, something like that. When we look at like that monoclonal antibody class, that's becoming more and more targeted. It's getting more and more expensive, but it's getting more and more common.
Right.
And then we kind of like layer up. There is now gene therapy where it's a cure. But these are getting more and more expensive. But like the baseline, we always had payment struggles with monoclonal antibodies. And as pharma identifies more of these outcomes, like I said, like hospitalizations is the easiest one, right? If you keep people out of the hospital, insurance companies are going to have less and less obstacles for the patient getting the drug. So let's say like drug comes out, right? And your doctor wants you on it and it's expensive. You change insurance, maybe it's covered. You kind of go through the gamut for a year, 2 years. And then, you know, it becomes very apparent that these patients are doing much better. And the cost to keep you out of a hospital, or the cost to, you know, prevent concomitant depression or impaired cognitive function or tardive dyskinesia or all these things that are so common with pills, they want you to come in and get this expensive drug, because in the long term, you're lowering that risk pool as insurers take all of us, charge a premium. There's high risk, there's low risk. People may feel like they're getting their value in insurance. Some people may not understand why they're paying it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like where it starts. But to like specifically answer your question, I think a lot of, and it's not what I specifically do, but I find myself in the, you know, patient payer, mm-hmm. you know, quality access, and I don't even know what the other one is. You know, I find myself in that triangle a lot, sitting with mm-hmm. not patients, crossing people, what the provider is, and they're talking about what their patients are saying. And there's really a ton of ways to get medications.
Yeah.
There really is. And it's not easy, right? Well, relative, right? Mm-hmm. It's probably hard compared to all the other drugs that maybe, let's say, like a 65-year-old at this current moment has. They're like, a prior authorization. Like, what is this? My doctor wrote it. My doctor used to write it on a sheet. I used to walk in. I used to walk out. And then I didn't have to call every year. I didn't have to wait on hold. All this stuff, right? So it is probably, you know, relatively hard for maybe people that this is sort of new. But, you know, that, like I said about like monoclonal antibodies and gene therapy and CAR T and specialized therapeutics, as we are all aging and getting through how to better do this, I think there is more education that,
yeah,
you know, advocacy groups pick up a lot often. Mm-hmm. Companies like mine and across industries also pick up a lot. Insurance companies don't always, sometimes. VA is an obstacle, right? A prior authorization is an obstacle, however you see it. But it's not always a bad thing, okay? Sometimes they want you to get an EKG.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of physicians are seeing so many patients. Oh, this has become like a whole healthcare talk tonight, and I feel like I'm only talking, but it's getting so much harder for them to see more and more patients as we have an aging populations with more and more diseases, right? We're living longer. It's good. It's all good. Maybe there's a shortage, staff shortage. It's getting harder for them to look at a PA, right? It's like, okay. Oh, all they need is an EKG. All right, I'll send them. And like, I'll remember, right? But they have 500 patients. And if 300 are getting the drug and 250 need an EKG, that's foreign. And that's a big shift in your practice that you're not all of a sudden getting paid for.
Yeah.
Academic healthcare systems, you name it, right? They're trying to shift to help that. If there's that many patients, they're going to take it off their provider's hands. They want them seeing patients. They want their patients having the best care. They want good outcomes, just like the patient, just like you guys, just like us, just like the healthcare systems. But there's just not enough time, right? By the time they implement this, you know, process or this team, they invest for this very specific drug on a little specialty team, and now it's generic, and now they don't have any hurdles, right? So it is very, very complex, but
I think there's a lot of things that we can, you know, for takeaways from this too, is just backing up a little bit to, you mentioned about the SGLT2s and then how they're used for diabetes. And then we find that they're very helpful for heart failure patients and very helpful for kidney failure. So kind of a cool process that drug has gone through, and then more studies, of course, because this anecdotal thing now needs to be studied, and then we're able to do those outcomes for patients. And talking about, you know, somebody with diabetes that then has other comorbidities such as heart failure or chronic kidney disease, taking one drug for all of those major problems and getting good outcomes, isn't that awesome? And so you can see that maybe perhaps there might be less prescribing cascade throughout that. And then we can optimize meds that much better because we have the one drug helping in hitting so many areas. So I love that you brought that up and how important it is to have that communication and continued education back and forth between pharma and providers and patient outcomes. I also think too that when you're talking about, you know, thinking about some of the medications and what, and I like to look back at some of the older ones that we've talked about. And, you know, some of the older medications that we had available to us might have caused a lot of side effects too, and it might not be as safe. So we know that there's things such as Beer's criteria that has a certain medications that should be used with caution or avoided in our older adults. The CDC has a study program that tells us to be super careful about particular medications in our older adults to reduce the risk of falls and target that. We know that there's a lot of these different avenues of looking at medications as well. So if we can come up with medications that are safer and in our helping our patients more with better outcomes, then by all means, we're all in this together. And I just wanted to make certain that we highlighted that. And I love the process that you've taken us through and how it isn't a straight line for folks, and that everyone's an individual. And we say this all the time, we're all individuals, and what works for one is not necessarily going to be the best for the other.
Yep. That's one thing I was curious, Ray. I mean, you've really talked about those complexities and taken us down like multiple journeys. So you guys have gotten a real education from Ray on almost the entire healthcare system and the inner workings. You know, next we'll do tax and finance with Ray. but all joking aside, bud, I'm really curious here. What do you think are the next steps? Because some of the things that are preventing us from getting some of this data in place and procuring it in a way that we can start detailing things out and helping patients sooner in the process, let's be honest with each other here and our audience, it's still somewhat archaic. And a lot of it has to do with some proprietary elements and, you know, there's personal health information that can't be exchanged. But are you seeing, I mean, I'm seeing from my perspective, more and more pharmaceutical companies investing in artificial intelligence and starting to partner with clinical bodies. What do you think will be the next phase for us, Ray, so that we can be able to target individuals that are going to benefit from these drugs and deprescribe the others more quickly?
Yeah, I think I'm a very pragmatic person. So as much as I would love to say, well, first of all, if I had a solution, I wouldn't have been talking about all the problems. I would have been selling my solution here. But aside from that, I hate to admit how I feel, but you know what Donna sort of just said is there's these growing pains, right? We need to sort of phase out all of those medications that providers feel comfortable just writing. You know, who knows, right? Same thing the way we talk about like identifying outcomes. I like using hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. We don't really know how to get there until it's been in the space for too long. But you know, how do we know that these specialty products, right, these hurdles, making them get on just this one drug, you know, that may be part of the PA, right? Try two other therapies, fail first, right? It's a headache. It's growing pains. It's a lot of work. It's expensive for the doctors, for the patients. It seems like we're going bouncing around our healthcare system, but in 40 years, we may have like a really good idea of how to identify which patients should get one individual drug, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, right? That's like a fantasy. I'm also defending sort of what I do, but it might be. We may never really know until it's there. But if there was a thinking more innovatively than like that, right? So that I think is sort of how it is going to go. In theory, I think we're at a very interesting time, I think, for healthcare. And I don't have a crystal ball, but it seems as though AI and targeted therapy and gene therapy can help tackle a ton of very specific things in our healthcare system, right? So like rare disease, things that require procedures, conveniently all things that are very expensive. But will we ever have like a targeted therapy for something that is being caused like throughout our periphery, like blood pressure, right? We may not really get there, but we have these good products because those markets have gone through everything I've already said, mm-hmm. right? They got approved years ago. So they've been generic for years. So maybe people have picked up these drugs or sort of manufactured them, tweaked them a little bit to make them look better, have a better profile, have better outcomes, you know, maybe have, because of like a better profile, have less of prior authorization or hurdles when they do get into the market and post approval, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it'll separate. But this is just, you know, should never put this in recording. I'll see how this is. I shouldn't put any inference, but I think our science is innovative, right? That's going to work. It's expensive. It's these hurdles. It's like, oh my God, thank God it's, you know, we have a treatment for cystic fibrosis. It's a cure. It only works in these patients that have this exact gene. Mm-hmm. And it's like all the other cystic fibrosis patients are like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like, I don't have, you know, that's not me. There's a cure and it's not mine, mm-hmm. but that's part of the growing pains, right? Like we have to bend the curve before we can change the direction because we can't just change the direction overnight. And I think, you know, I made sure I'm not going to talk anything about my company, but I like using company examples because some of these are huge, right? We're talking about like heart disease and the SGLT2s and Victoza getting cardiac. This is not my company, but I think the Alzheimer's drug was big enough that a lot of people saw it in the news. And it's like, oh my God, it's so expensive. And that's, you know, it doesn't even work. It didn't get approved. And then they did a subgroup and it's like all very fishy behind doors. Like as a patient, it's like, what is going on? Like, should I be getting this? Should I be like paying for this? Yeah. Right. But we have to bend the curve first. You know, patients have to take it for years to see if they live longer. We can't find out in a 24-week trial if patients are going to live longer. We can. We have statistics, as you two both know, but, you know, for our audience, like, we have very sophisticated analyses that can extrapolate 24 weeks into, wouldn't say a lifetime, but years, right, with a very, very small percentage that it happened by chance. But that's without all these intangibles we've been talking about. Right. Being on 8 meds, actually probably being on 2 meds when you first started the drug and then being on another 6 come the time that, you know, you may pass or enter a long-term care facility.
You know, what's so funny, Ray, is I thought when we were starting this episode, I thought this is going to be a great episode for those that want to understand the drug process, you know, like how do drugs come on board? How do they get processed into their clinician's office? And then how do they take them and be the most effective? But I think you've given us one of the best examples of why patients should be their own advocates. I mean, the importance of them staying on board with all these changes. And as you mentioned, the growing pains of the healthcare system and the evolution that we're going through, that those caregivers and those patients have to be their own advocates when it comes to non-pharmaceutical ways that they're going to take care of themselves and avoid disease progression, on what's the latest and greatest things that are being changed. And why did the particular elements about their personal record, you know, their family history, their genetics, et cetera, play such a big pivotal role in the future of their potential healthcare needs. That's really, thank you for that. That's been really illuminating in several ways. Don, any other closing remarks?
And I just have to say, like, you know, this time of year, I always think about, you know, what's the conversation around the Thanksgiving table, right? And it's either politics or health typically. And I think that this gives a lot of food for thought in regards to the healthcare side of things. And something that I've been promoting for the past, you know, year or so is let's change the conversation instead of saying, oh, I now take this for this. Let's talk about what we're deprescribing and what we're treating better and how good we're feeling around the Thanksgiving table versus, oh, this year, you know, this is going on. Now I have this and this. So, so I'm hoping that we can have people feel healthier and stronger and med strong, right? As I throw in my little plug for my book. Yeah. But anyways, like just thinking about that and thinking about, you know, how industry can help us. I think that's really important. I think we have to see both sides, right? We can't, I think, you know, pharma, pharmacy, everyone's kind of, there's been a lot in the news over the past year, especially with all the different areas of the healthcare system. But I think it's important that folks know that we do want good health outcomes for them. And we're just at a very interesting area right now. So I do want to also remind people that it's Medicare open enrollment too. Sorry if I take a moment for that, but let's help out the people who we love. As you have those lists, make certain that you are looking at them, that you're looking at inappropriate, unnecessary medications. Is our mom and dad falling? Is grandma and grandpa, are they in the hospital more often this year, as Ray was pointing out too? So, and why is that? Start asking those hard questions. You have the list. Start investigating, and you can do that through the book MedStrong, or talking to your doctors and prescribers, and any healthcare encounter is important to ask these questions.
Awesome, love it. Well, thank you so much, Ray, for being with us. You're absolutely fantastic. Donna, always good to see you, and thank you everybody for being here with us on the MedList, and we will see you next time.